You're listening to WTUL New Orleans. This is the News and Views Show, and you're here with DJ Under the Bus. Today, we're going to be doing an interview with the producer of a brand new film documentary called Shattered Families. It's the history of the broken mental health system. And Nikki joined up with the filmmaker, Dr. Steven Seeger, who's a psychiatrist who worked at the psychiatric facility in Napa State in California, which is one of the largest in the country. So she's going to tell us how she came to know about Dr. Seeger and his work. And then also, one of the people who features prominently in the film, Laura Pogliano from Maryland, Baltimore, I believe, she's going to tell us a little bit about her story and what she's doing in Baltimore to help families in crisis who otherwise can't get care for their loved ones with serious mental illness. And so we're going to start the interview. Thank you so much, both of you, for being on. Hi, Nikki. Hi, Laura.
Hi, thank you so much for having us.
Well, I really appreciate you both doing this on such short notice. Why don't we start with you, Nikki? So how did you come to know about the film Shattered Families, and why did you decide you wanted to produce the film?
Project because I'm someone who didn't have any kind of focused attention on mental illness. I do have extended family who have been touched by serious depression, and of course friends along the way, but I never really paid, you know, any direct attention to the system and how it really just doesn't take care of the people who need immediate care. So I heard Dr. Seeger on a podcast, and he started to talk about his situation working as a forensic psychiatrist and promoting his book, Behind the Gates of Gomorrah. And I was absolutely horrified by what I heard, the working conditions he found himself in, and how he was trying to treat patients who, at this hospital, some of whom were there for, you know, different conditions, but there was a certain segment who were sent there from the courts who were found criminally insane.
Right, and just... Just for listeners that might not know, Dr. Seeger, he also is the author of the book Behind the Gates of Gomorrah, A Year with the Criminally Insane, and documents the conditions in the hospital that he worked in. And Nikki, you can take it from there, but I understand it was really, there's a lack of staff workers, a lack of funding to provide good services and facilities for the patients there, and so people were getting injured on the job. And he wrote about
Precisely.
That, and he risked his job, I believe, to write about that as well, because he was a whistleblower.
Yeah, precisely. And on day one, actually, he had his head slammed against a wall by one of the patients. But what really struck me, I mean, there were several things. I was just really overwhelmed by what he was describing. But one of the things he was saying, which is should be very basic, there was no security in place within the hospital. Basically, it was the staff. Protecting, trying to defend themselves from people who, and these are the people who are violent. This is a small percentage of the mentally ill population. They're, you know, very small. However, when you're exposed in an environment that doesn't contain certain people who are prone to attacking you and just on a whim, that's, I was kind of astounded that the powers that be within the system didn't spend the money to put some kind of security measures in a place of work, and people can't work that way. So that, long story short, I reached out to him after this interview by email saying, I heard your story, I got his book, I read it in 2 days, and I said, would you consider bridging this into a documentary so people can get a visual sense of what you're trying to say? And he said, you know what, this story is so much bigger than me. It really extends into the families who I've come across over the years who are suffering, who cannot get treatment for their loved ones. And so we just started a discussion, and I've learned so much up to this point. It's just been an amazing experience. And we came to connect with Laura through BJ Jaffe and other people, and we just Shattered Families took shape.
Right.
Over the course of 2 years.
DJ Jaffe is the executive director of Mental Illness Policy Org, and actually that's how I also came into contact with Laura. Laura is one of the families who's been impacted by lack of funding and policies to care for people with untreated mental illness. Laura, why don't you tell us a little bit about your story and about Zach, your son?
Well, thanks, G. Janet. My son, Zach, was 16, just before his 17th birthday. He started to make very morose statements, and then he started to say things that didn't make sense. And then we started seeing a regular doctor, then a psychologist, then a psychiatrist. And over the period of the first year of his illness, they diagnosed him with bipolar with psychotic features. And then over time, they revised that diagnosis to schizophrenia because his psychosis got so much worse, even under good medical care. And yeah, he really declined. I always say there are stories of recovery, and then there are stories like Zach. And Zachary is probably part of the 4% who don't recover, don't respond well to medicine, have a persistent chronic mental illness. They're dealing with it every day. It's not episodic, for example. And he really had a hard time getting his illness under control. So I met Dr. Seeger on Facebook, and then I met Nikki. And I think the family stories are the most important thing that we can do to help people find serious mental illness relatable to themselves. I think they can't relate to a patient who is so far out of reality, but I think they can relate to the families, and so I was glad to be part of this film.
Right, and talk about your experience with trying to care for Zach in a system that didn't offer you much support.
Yeah.
What kind of a toll does that take on the family? And now you also have an organization to offer support for families who are dealing with mental illness crisis because of your experience of not being able to get help.
That's true.
So maybe just explain to listeners a little bit about what's that like, and why did you decide to start your organization to help others?
Well, you know, when you are caring for someone with schizophrenia, major depressive disorder, bipolar disorder, a persistent and chronic illness, you take on all the duties of caregiving, but you also take on all the duties of caregiving and psychiatric care. So I used to say, you know, I was a mother, and I'm the breadwinner of the family. I was single. I was never married. I raised two children by myself. So I am the breadwinner still to this day, and I have to earn a living. Well, the enormous pressure that our family was under, with me trying to go to work every day, get back to therapy 5 days a week, drive him to numerous blood test appointments, pharmacy, doctor appointment, therapist appointment. I had to be a med tech. I had to be a therapist. I had to be a driver. I had to be his mom. I had to be a nurse who understood his condition. I had to fulfill all these roles that are not provided for in the mental health world. They really give your child a diagnosis, and a devastating diagnosis like schizophrenia. And then you take them home, and you figure it all out yourself. So there are support organizations like NAMI. That's a national organization. I found that they weren't very helpful when I really had crises. They're very good at supporting families, helping families understand what mental illness is. But there's zero help if you're really in crisis. If you are in financial crisis, if you're in a crisis of decompensation at home, and probably our worst crisis ever was my son going off a very strong medicine, becoming floridly psychotic, and then going to bed thinking he had broken bones, broken back, crushed ankles, brain tumor, and refusing to get up. So for 2 weeks he didn't eat or drink in his bed while I begged him to go see a begging work, and that's our choice. We have set up a voluntary system, and many, many people, like my son, cannot volunteer. So that's why we call it the broken system in part, that we expect very sick people whose cognitive abilities are compromised due to illness to make all these good medical decisions for themselves, and they can't.
Yeah, I'm nodding my head. I'm nodding my head because I personally can relate to the situation, but not anywhere near to the extent of from what you've been through. But I think also people they just don't understand the physical and emotional toll it takes on the caregiver. And you know, you're expected to do all of this while at the same time working, you know, being the breadwinner, holding down a job or whatever, and you don't know when a crisis is coming around the corner, and so you don't know when you have to take time off work or when you don't. But I think, you know, Nikki, you probably doing the work that you did working with Dr. Seeger, heard these kinds of stories over and over. And what was your... Go ahead.
Yeah, I was going to say, I was absolutely floored. I mean, this makes no sense. Because someone who's suffering from a serious illness like schizophrenia, who needs immediate attention, Laura had to go through all these hoops to get that attention, and I don't get it. And she makes a brilliant point in our documentary that you would never treat someone with Alzheimer's this way. You know, you would be found negligent if you kind of just left them to their own, you know, devices. And, well, when that person suddenly becomes a danger, then, you know, we'll insert professional care and the whole thing. It just doesn't – I don't understand why the medical industry treats schizophrenia as a behavioral issue when I would sit – now, again, I'm coming at this from a novice's perspective, which I think that makes our project unique because Seeger has been in the trenches and he – kind of nosy, as well as Laura, obviously, but I come at this wide-eyed, what on earth is going on? So Laura just really beautifully expressed her, just, you know, agony, trying to get her some help, and I just don't understand why it takes so much, you know, roadblocks and trying to beg for people's attention on the phone, and then there's not a bed available. It just, you know, and bit by bit, I'm learning how that works, you know, state by state and the laws and the whole thing. So
one other thing, which is that even after I got my son removed from the house and into a hospital, he spent 13 days in a hospital at great expense. It costs money to stay in a hospital. He spent 13 days in the hospital without even a single aspirin because he still refused care. So during that first 2 weeks in the hospital, he wasn't eating or drinking either. Just very basic, you know, take a sip of water. He lost 25 pounds at home, and he lost another 15 in the hospital before we could get forcibly medicate him. So even after he was removed to the hospital, I had to have two court battles inside the hospital. The first, to take away his competency, to declare him incompetent. And then even that was not enough to get medicine. We had to have a second court session to decide if he was sick enough to be forcibly medicated, and we almost lost that. I run into a doctor every so often from Hopkins who still brings it up. Remember when we almost lost that? You know, we almost lost his life because a nurse wrote down that he ate a half a cup of rice, and so they said, well, he's not in danger of starving. So it's really ridiculous, and no other brain illness is treated this way. We would be negligent if we did this to people. Instead, we throw them in the gutter. We throw them in prisons and jails. And we, you know, dig them up in the morgue because of our policies that state that a standard of dangerousness has to be met for the person to require care. So he was 2 weeks at home. He was 2 weeks in the hospital. And then it was another full 2.5 months before he was competent again, and he had no idea where the last 3 months went, and he had no idea why he had thought his everything in his body was broken. You know, he sort of woke up out of a Sleeping Beauty incident and said, what the hell just happened to me? He was 40 pounds thinner, and he'd lost 3 months of his life. So something's got to change, and we are hoping that we'll take to this film, see it, understand ridiculous policy.
Yeah, it seems to me that's what really struck me also when I watched the film about, you know, how these well-intentioned laws that were meant to provide systems to help people like Zach and others were never either funded or implemented, which left a vacuum for lawyers and advocacy groups to sort of come into the picture. And they were more interested in protecting doctors from lawsuits and protecting the failed system, which has punished families and the people that it was designed to help. And that those advocacy groups, the groups that filled that vacuum, are incredibly powerful and seem to not want the system to change. So I know Laura and I have been battling for passage of federal legislation for comprehensive health reform, which has been, you know, which it seems like it should be an easy, no-brainer thing to do, but the opposition has been overwhelming by groups that don't want the system to change. Film is a powerful documentary just about the how the laws have evolved to create this failure in the system. And
that's right. And prior to participating in this project, I, you know, was a member of society. When shootings and terrible tragedies hit the mainstream media, have a fleeting moment of attention to someone who clearly was, well, of course, the post-analysis, someone who needs mental health treatment. So why, from a very removed standpoint, well, why didn't that person get help? Since working on this project, you really delve into deep waters and you see exactly why. It is not that simple, and not only is it not that simple, it's an incredible just tangle of policy that just doesn't work. It doesn't fly, and that's what Dr. Seeger presents from his narration. And I don't think the common everyday person is really aware of how dysfunctional the system is. I think because the film strikes an emotional chord, that's mm-hmm. really going to help, you know, further the message.
I agree, Nikki. I think the everyday average person hasn't got a clue about what mental illness is. They see the symptoms of the illnesses and want those symptoms to go away. You know, they want people who are homeless to be housed. They want people with so-called behavioral problems, which are just symptoms of often a medical brain disease. It's often a medical illness that causes a person's behavior, not because a person is intentionally misbehaving. And so people get punished for their behavior. I mean, this is a problem with the criminal justice system. And, you know, because there have been no inpatient resources, people with serious brain diseases and serious mental illnesses have become a problem for the corrections department, law enforcement, and judges. And those systems are designed to correct behavior. But it doesn't matter how hard you beat a person with a serious mental illness, you will not correct the behavior unless you deal with the symptom, and the symptom is medical. And I think that analogy to Alzheimer's disease is a really good one, because we don't treat people with dementia, elderly people with dementia, the same way we treat people with mental illness who may have a similar, you know, delusions or misperceptions of reality. So, you know, why is that, right? Like, why can't we fix this system? And I think the emotional appeal, you're right, and especially in politics, because the political realm is an emotional realm. You know, you can present as much data and scientific evidence as you want before a legislator, and it's like deer in the headlights. They don't even register. But when you tell your story about, you know, your emotional and physical exhaustion, they get that because they know what that feels like. But, and you know, another thing, people never talk about property damage as, you know, one of the costs of untreated mental illness. But I hear all the time, I mean, family members get injured just like doctors and nurses by their own loved ones who are delusional, who don't mean to hurt them, but they act out. And sometimes family members get injured. That's a cost. Sometimes property damage happens, right? I mean, people that are delusional break things. There was somebody here in Orleans Parish that burned down their parents' house. insurance isn't going to cover for that. So these are all ancillary costs. And when people say it's too expensive to fix the system, or that, you know, hospital beds instead of jail cells would cost too much money, they're not looking at the ancillary costs of mental illness. Because when you add it all up, and job loss, I mean, how much are businesses losing every day because their employees have to take time off work to deal with a person in crisis? So, you know, it's this whole systemic, it's unsustainable. I mean, look at what's economically, this epidemic is costing the country, you know, billions of dollars a year, and the billions of dollars that are spent aren't getting to the people that need it the most. I mean, maybe Laura can talk a little bit about that, because I know that the federal government spends upward to $200+ billion a year on mental illness. So why are we seeing increases in incarceration, homelessness, and death?
Well, the agency that is responsible for mental health and substance abuse is called SAMHSA, the Substance Abuse and Mental Health Services Administration, and they are get funding to the tune of $3.6 billion a year. Now, if that funding was used wisely in places where it was needed, we would not have nearly 1 million incarcerated homeless and 750,000 are incarcerated mentally ill, and 750,000 homeless mentally ill people. So what SAMHSA does is focus on mental wellness and mental health and substance abuse. And in fact, the substance abuse model of recovery is now accepted as a model of recovery for mental illness, which is that let the mentally ill hit rock bottom and decide he needs to change. Which is just the most ridiculous thing on earth, but that's what SAMHSA supports. So $3.6 billion a year should be able to do something about our problems, you would think. That's not a small amount of money, but it's wasted on programs like Dance Away Your Blues and yoga and what I call kitty cat pictures, you know, right. Coloring books for adults, and what does that have to do with the serious mentally ill who are suffering chronic progressive brain diseases, brain damage, living out on our streets, completely forsaken, completely neglected, without medical care, and now, in many, many cases, just automatically incarcerated and warehoused in our jails and prisons? It has nothing to do with treating the seriously mentally ill.
Yeah, Nikki, I just want to let you know, we just have a minute or two left, so, and we're going to be talking about all these things on Sunday at the screening, which will be 4 to 6 p.m. at the First Universalist Unitarian Church on Jefferson and Claiborne here in New Orleans, but Nikki, you were about to say something, and then Laura, I also want listeners to know your organization that you began to support families and what legislation they can support to change the system. But go ahead, Nikki.
Yeah, I was quickly going to echo Laura's point. When we, Francis Greenberger, who also appears on documentary, and he founded the Greenberger Center for Social and Criminal Justice, the stats, just in New York State, Rikers, for example, 40% of the inmates have some form of mental illness. Now, that is a huge number. It's almost half of the people who are behind bars. What, you know, and his agenda is to try to open, you know, alternative facilities to where people can go, can get care, number one, and not just be rotting in a jail cell. So that's another key aspect point, and that was another eye-opener for me, yeah, working on the project, so.
Right. No, those are incredible statistics. And I mean, if that doesn't wake people up, if people won't wake up to the humanitarian issues, they should at least wake up to the, you know, economic the cost of all of this. So, but go ahead, Laura, and what do you want listeners? What do you want listeners to know about what they can do to change the system? And talk about a little. Just mention your organization. And I know you were featured in Oprah Winfrey's magazine recently.
So, if people want to do something about mental illness, the very first thing that you can do, and one of the most important things you can do, it doesn't cost us a nickel. Is call your senator, call your congressman, and tell them the conditions are not acceptable and that we have to pass mental health legislation. There's a good bill up. It provides for a lot of closing up some of the system gaps. And so if a listener wants to do something at home, they can call their senator. You can Google Find My Rep. It's very easy, and they're perfectly willing to speak to you. So call your senators and congressmen and tell them, the time is now for mental health reform, not a year from now. We've got Sandy Hook behind us. We've got Colorado. We've got the Denver shooter, right? We've got more than enough examples. We need to change our mental health system, and the time to reform that is now. So otherwise, my organization is called Parents for Care. People can visit us at www.parentsforcare.com, and we help families struggling with the demands of caregiving for someone with serious mental illness. So we provide medical notebooks. They're very nicely formatted for you to take notes at the doctor, partner with your son or daughter's or loved one's physician, keep track of appointment meds, symptoms, things like that. Those are for sale on our site. We have a support group that meets monthly. We also have a small grant program, and we take donations in small amounts and we roll them up into bigger packages, and then we give families struggling with financial crisis while raising someone with mental illness. We're able to give small grants to sort of get them through a bad time. So to date, we've given away $25,300 to about 25 families.
That's great.
The average grant is about $800. And I always say the money says more than just the cash. The money says we're behind you, don't give up. Because so many families like mine face severe financial crisis, and this is a lifelong illness. So they're going to have these problems forever caring for their loved one.
Right.
But so many families just get in financial crisis, and then they themselves become homeless, have to downsize, you know, all kinds of things. So we give out grants for groceries, medicine, rent, food, that's a big one, and medicine.
Thank you, Laura. That's the reason I asked you to mention your organization is because I think it's a fantastic model that other cities can follow until we get some sorts of systems in place that should be in place to fill that vacuum. I really appreciate both of you being on today. Listeners, you can check out Shattered Families this coming Sunday, September the 11th. From 4 to 6 p.m. at the First Unitarian Universalist Church of New Orleans. That's at 2903 Jefferson Avenue. There will be a discussion afterward with some folks here right in New Orleans who are going through these very same issues and have endured tragedies because of the broken health system, as well as mental health experts that will be on hand to let us know what we can do in our local and state community to change laws that will better our system and have some meaningful impact. Nikki, Laura, I just really, again, can't thank you enough for not only all of the work that you do, but for coming on this show on such short notice. I have to say, Laura replied to me like 2 minutes ago to say that she was available to come and talk on the show. So, can't thank you both enough.
I'm so glad it worked out. Thank you.